Welcome to WeAreTechnology.com's User Friendly 2.0 with host Bill Sickens, Technology Architect.
And this is User Friendly 2.0. I am your host, Bill Sickens. Joining me, Bill and Gretchen, welcome to this week's show.
Hello there.
Hello.
So we've got a really cool guest interview coming up again this week in the second segment, getting a lot of different perspective from authors. And this has been really kind of cool and a little bit unexpected. And it's kind of neat to see the different direction that different people take for their art, you know, or as I think he calls it today, the craft. I always thought that was doing movies, but I guess that's also writing books. And but, you know, the different directions and a lot of really good stuff. And, you know, I'm going to want to sit down and actually read through some of these things, but it does take some doing. One of the other interviews that we're going to have in a couple of weeks is an author that's actually, he was going to write a book and he's written five. And from what I've seen of it, they're actually really good. So I haven't seen any bummers yet, which is kind of cool. Another set that's going to be coming up in a few weeks is a cyberpunk fantasy, but where the world gets good. And I tried to explain to him, there's no way that's cyberpunk, but at least not with that conclusion. But we shall see, I suppose.
Well, anyway. Okay, here's the question. Has cyberpunk become a genre?
Yeah, it's been a genre for a while.
Right, so then, you know, it can go either way. It doesn't have to be.
Yeah, it can. Mm-hmm. I don't disagree with you on that, but part of what cyberpunk is kind of this post-apocalyptic, everything's horrible idea. I think if you tried to make it good, it wouldn't really be cyberpunk. However, I will say that from what I understand, the way they put this together, it kind of keeps its, you know, that intact. So we'll see. And again, it'll be interesting to see where that goes. And then for that particular one, since we're talking about it, their books are set 100 years after Cyberpunk 2077. So I don't know, maybe good things happen in 100 years. We shall see. Alrighty, on that cheery note, what do we have in the news this week?
Okay, oh my god, this term is just like really freaking me out. It's kind of intense. Pig butchering scams increasing. What exactly is this?
Okay, first of all, just for everybody, don't worry about it. From a standpoint, this is not literally what the headline says. This has nothing to do with pigs or animals or anything like that. It's just a term that they're using. But what it is it's a scam that has cost over $75 billion in loss over the past 4 years and is something that's quite intense, you know? So what this basically comes down to is it's a long-term situation. So it's people that are kind of trying to scam for the long term. So you get an unsolicited call or email or whatever, you respond to it, and you talk to somebody who gets into your confidence. And they'll talk to you, they'll send personal messages throughout the day, and then later they invite you to join them in a cryptocurrency trade. Okay, what could go wrong here? And they discuss openly with you personal finances, purchases, and vacations. And then finally, your new online friend asks you to send money. So if this is going on or you get an unsolicited anything, don't do it. Because there's a lot of different techniques out there for these people to take you and your money and have you part from each other. And we're seeing a lot of different approaches, this just being another one. And at the end of the day, you're not going to make money off cryptocurrency doing this. I'm still of the opinion that unless you're very lucky, you're not going to make money off cryptocurrency, period. Yeah. But this is one where you almost certainly won't. You're going to lose anything you put in.
So in other words, the victim becomes the pig.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that's where that term comes from.
On same note, hackers infest users of antivirus service that deliver updates over HTTP.
Yeah, so from a technical perspective, the first thing I had to ask is, it seems like delivering or doing your antivirus over your browser or getting the updates, which is what this would be, I could see there being a lot of problems with that. I mean, you download updates, but it's usually done by the antivirus software that you're running, not through this type of an interface. So what's been going on here, and they think the hackers are tied to North Korea. So this is a government thing that's been going on with it. And they're using something called a man-in-the-middle attack. And basically what that means is they're interfering with the data transfer, but not on the end of the company you're getting it from and not on your end. So the antivirus company sends the correct information. They replace it with a malicious file while it's in transit. And then what you receive is the malicious file. So that's how that works.
Yeah.
And these type of things, it takes a lot to pull off, and it's very complicated in the way that they do this. But this is, just to kind of sum it up, a big reason why you want the HTTPS on your browser. And I still wouldn't download antivirus updates in this way, but that at least tells you the website is communicating with you. And as far as I know, and they have hacked this before, but the current standard of this does lock it down. So if you know, or at least you should know, hopefully, that the website you're dealing with is really what it purports to be. So these kind of attacks, they're not new, but this methodology of doing it is newer. However, this has been going on since 2019, apparently. The company, by the way, is called eScan. So if you're using eScan, I would suggest getting different antivirus software. But this has been going on since 2019, which is 5 years that they didn't seem to notice it.
Wow.
You know, so I have a hard time with stuff like that, because it's, you know, it's one thing. Okay, they hack in, they get in a way that you didn't expect it, you deal with it and move on. But a 5-year breach like this is a little weird. But in any event, if you're using eScan at this point, just it would be time to upgrade your antivirus software, or just simply use the one that comes with Windows if you're running Windows 11 or Windows 10, because it works well too. It's going to certainly work better than something you get through the web like that.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Okay. Why vector databases are having a moment as the AI hype cycle peaks. What exactly is a vector database?
Okay, so Gretchen, why don't you... I was going to say, to get started with this, maybe you could explain the difference between SQL, NoSQL, vector databases, and things like that.
I could make something up. It wouldn't it'd be a bunch of nonsense.
In most cases, I don't think anybody would know the difference unless you work within it. This is a very, very analytical topic. But what's going on here is they're talking about different styles of databases. So when you use the internet, or many other things for that matter, you're probably interacting with a database. You might not directly know that you are, but most interactive technology that sends you information of some kind has to pull it from somewhere, and usually that's a database. And there's many different ways to set that up on the back end to be able to provide this information. One of the most common ones is something called SQL, SQL. It stands for Structured Query Language, and it's basically a database that holds information that's in a structure of some kind. So you want the name, address, phone number, email address to be saved. That's the structure. And then you have whatever records go along with it. This is the very similar system to some of the old softwares we used to have, like DBase and others, that FileMaker Pro, I think, was like this anyway, that keep Microsoft Access is another big one. Sorry, I'm just trying to think, and it's having to get the rust off the brain to go back that far. But in any event, the modern systems use these kind of databases in a newer way than Microsoft Access, et cetera, to be able to store information, and they work pretty well if you have a structure. Problem is not everything works that way. So if you're storing videos or images or something that doesn't adhere to a predefined data model, SQL doesn't work that well for dealing with it. So that is where you get things that are commonly called NoSQL. And vector databases are something that would fall into that category. And really where they're coming into this is generative AI, as they're trained, use this kind of a database a lot better than SQL and some of the other things that are out there. And one of the things they've been finding is that using this kind of a back end allows AIs to reduce what they call hallucinations. And what that is where the AI gives you completely fictitious information or something of that nature. Call that a hallucination. And one of the reasons for that is because, depending on how the AI is developed and what it actually is, it's pulling from a massive database, but it's not necessarily going to know in certain situations whether the information it has is real or not. Some do, some don't. So at the end of the day, that's where you have had problems, and probably seen in the news where there was a lawyer that did this and some other examples, that they wrote their stuff using an AI that didn't have this differentiation capability. And the information was written well, but it was completely false.
Great.
You know, because it doesn't know if it's pulling it from reality or from, you know, the Harry Potter book or something. It's that kind of a thing. So in any event,
so
what's happening is AI is starting to really get into everything. The systems that run it are becoming more and more popular. And vector databases, which is probably not something most of us have even heard about before, are coming to the forefront. So to try and keep this from being really deep technical, it just simply means that when you interact with an AI, you might not be interacting with the same kind of database you have on other things. And whether that is relevant to you is your end to figure out.
Non-competes are dead and tech workers are free to roam.
So this came in, this is from Wired Magazine, and what this is talking about is the Federal Trade Commission is putting a new rule in that invalidates non-compete agreements. And there's two sides of thought on this. I know in my career I've dealt with this. Basically what it comes down to is I go work for Company A, and Company A has me sign an agreement that I can't go work for Company B, which would be their competitor, you doing the same thing for 3 years, 2 years, whatever the term of the non-compete is. Problem with that is when you leave Company A, you're not allowed to practice your expertise in certain situations. So this type of thing has been controversial, to say the least. And at the end of the day, it's taken the Federal Trade Commission to step in here and deal with this. They're saying that it's going to create about 8,500 new businesses annually, not jobs, but actual businesses. An average annual pay increase of $524 for each worker, lower health costs, and as many as 29,000 more patents each year over the next decade. Now, the one thing that I do have to footnote on this from Wired's article is the non-competes are not dead yet. There's about a four-month process that this has to go through with the FTC, and there are some powerful people objecting to this new rule, saying that it's an overreach and that kind of thing. But it may actually end up in front of the Supreme Court. However, if it does get to that point, we might still see the legislation change. It's just not going to be tomorrow. And it's just important to note that this isn't in effect yet.
All right. TSMC says A16 chip making tech to arrive in 2026, setting up showdown with Intel.
Okay, well, that was a lot of letters.
I'm assuming one of them is a company and the other one is a product?
Yeah, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, by the way, is what that stands for. And the other part that was all letters in there, A16, is a model of a microprocessor. Sounded like it. So that's what all that kind of breaks down to. So, you know, there's a number of different companies that make the central processing units that are used in a lot of our things, and the Intel, AMD are some of the most common ones, but there are other companies out there that put these things together. And this is setting itself up to be a direct competitor to Intel and AMD, which would be interesting because you might have a third kind of computer processor that you would get someday. Now, this isn't that unusual. Like Apple uses their own thing and a lot of others do. But for the most part, you're probably, if you're not using a Mac, you probably have a computer that has either Intel or AMD. It's not 100%, but it is the most common thing out there. And that's why this could be a big deal, and it could actually help to bring down prices and that type of thing to have more options out there. So it'll be interesting to see where this ends up. But if it does come out and if it is successful, it certainly will give a third class. Now, the one thing not to worry about is that doesn't mean you're going to have a third operating system or anything like that. The idea is this would run what is on the market now today. It'd just be a different method or a different brand, if you will, of doing it. So whether you have an RCA television or a LG television, you can watch the same television signal, same idea.
Mm-hmm. Deadpool and Wolverine trailer released.
Yeah, so it's in post-production. This has been talked about for a while and kind of our next movie like this. And I have to say Wolverine and Deadpool are some of the two most violent characters out there. So this could be very interesting to see where this ends up and if it's something we're going to be saying after you finish watching the movie. Its expected release date is July 26th. It's in post-production now, so we'll see if they meet that or not, which usually they do at this point. But you never know what happens. So, you know, we'll have to check this one out because this is a kind of movie that is a genre that most of us like.
Deadpool and Wolverine, those are two individuals that are extremely hard to kill. by nature of their superpowers or whatever you want to call it, these are two people who have a hard time dying. So if they were to get in a fight with each other, that's probably going to go on for a long time.
Now, that would be interesting. I think maybe that's the movie we need.
Who knows? know?
Instead of Deadpool and Wolverine, maybe we could have Deadpool versus Wolverine. I don't know. Someone call what franchise is this? Marvel, I think. Yeah, someone call a franchise and let them know that we want a versus instead of an
ant. They fight each other and then become friends? Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know what the storyline is. There hasn't been a lot of talk about that yet. But like you say, and the other thing is the characters are very different. I mean, Wolverine is kind of almost a
staunch. Moody, I don't know if it's military, but that grumpy, kind of an idea. Deadpool, on the other hand, is like, look at the camera and wave to you. You know, that
like a loudmouth who takes nothing seriously.
What is this, a fourth barrier? Or what is that called?
Yes, exactly. Well,
Fourth wall.
So, anyway, the other thing that's interesting, I know some of the characters in here, or the actors, rather, are people. Patrick Stewart's going to be back as Professor X.
Really?
From what I understand. Ray Park is going to be in the movie, so that'll be interesting. I don't think he'll be red, but he'll be there. so we'll see where this ends up going. This has the potential to be really good or really bad. I don't know. And sometimes it's
a little hit and miss. California lawmakers rein in bill to limit car speeds. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so in a shocking revelation, the state of California wanted to create a rule that by 2029, at least 50% of new vehicles, and by 2032, all new vehicles sold in the state had a governor installed. It would know the speed limit of where you were and would not allow you to exceed it. I think there was a 10-mile-per-hour variance in there and that kind of a thing. And believe it or not, there were a few people that had a problem with that. And I can't understand why. I mean, you know, it's the speed limit's fine, but for safety or something, you do need to be able to speed up a little bit. You wouldn't be able to do that. And the other side of it is technology does fail sometimes. What if it has that the wrong speed really limit bad. For where you are?
Yeah.
You know, so they have changed this now for anybody that is concerned. I say that tongue in cheek because this is just such a weird thing to think about that an outside influence would be able to have that on your private vehicle. I know governors and things like that exist on commercial vehicles and some other things, but that's still a little bit different than my Nissan, you know? And from that standpoint, that's where a lot of people are like, you know, objecting to this. So it's been modified now that the requirement is still there to have a thing that will advise you if you exceed the speed limit in the same capacity where 50% in 2029 and so on. But it just has a lighter warning or something. It doesn't physically keep your car from speeding up.
Retrofitting other cars, or are they grandfathered in? That's good.
No, there doesn't seem to be any kind of like a backward requirement. So if you have an older vehicle, you know, that doesn't have this, or right now any vehicle,
and you know, once again, you're going to
be prohibited from using it in the state of California. It's just anything new
that people are not going to want in other states.
Yeah. You know. But yeah, the adoption of these type of things, this is a lot like electric vehicles. There's no rule that you can't have a gasoline powered car, except that all cars sold, I think, by 2030 have to meet such stringent pollution requirements that they could only be an electric car, you know. So, but you're, you know, my 1970, whatever, what is it, 66 Volkswagen Bug is still legal to drive, even after these rules go into effect, without having to change it in some way.
Yeah. Voyager 1 is talking again.
Yes. And this has been an interesting thing for especially space enthusiasts, which seems to be everybody at NASA. Imagine that. So what happened is for anybody that doesn't know, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are the only human-made objects that are in interstellar space. In other words, have left our solar system. And they're still both in communication with us. But about 6 months ago, it was last fall sometime, there was a problem where Voyager 1 was sending back information, but the information was gobbledygook. It wasn't able to be used in any way, and something was scrambling it. So they were trying to figure it out. Well, you know, when you're updating software, that is a project debugging that is its own beast sometimes. But in this case, for everything they did, it's 22 and a half hours for the radio signal to reach Voyager, make the change, and then another 22 and a half hours to know if it worked, to see if you get different information back. So, and then on top of that, you're dealing with technology that was built in the 70s, and there aren't a lot of people around that can support that anymore either, you know? It's outside of pinball machines, we seem to be able to fix them okay. But no, in all seriousness, what they ended up doing is they figured out that what was causing the problem is a chip in the system had failed. Now, again, these missions were supposed to be 5 years, so the fact that they're even still running, I can't fault it for that after all this time. But what they ended up doing is they were able to move the code into other parts of the system's memory. It was too big to fit in any of the other pieces of themselves, so they broke it up. I mean, whoever programmed this really knew what they were doing. And then they tested it out, and they've been able to do that in such a way that they've been able to completely bypass the memory chip that went out. And they're now getting data back that is what they need it to be, which is kind of really cool to think that, you know,
I think it's awesome.
Do think that qualifies as the farthest away service call ever performed.
Yeah, without doubt.
Now, I think it's cool they were able to fix it. And I think a lot of people kind of had figured, you know, that was kind of the end of it. And it wouldn't have really been that negative of the thing, because, again, you're dealing with systems that were not meant to do what they're doing in any capacity, you know? I mean, when the Voyagers went up, the Atari system was just brand new. You got to think about it. That's where we are. I don't even think we had VCRs and stuff like that yet. And if we did, it was in the very, very early phases of them. You know, you listen to music off a record, or they did have 8 tracks. So there was at least that, you know, and this thing still works. And they were, and not only that, when there was a malfunction, they were actually able to bring it back. So that's pretty cool. You know, I don't know. I am in the space stuff. I always have been. So it's kind of fun to see some of the things that come out of here. One other thing that came to from one of the Mars orbiters,
just
on this kind of a topic, is they found spiders on Mars. Oh. I'm sure, Gretchen, you would love that. Yeah, not really. Not at least in what you would think. What they found on Mars, though, is something that from atmosphere looks like spiders. But what it is actually a geological process that causes carbon dioxide to bring darker material up to the surface during what they would consider to be their spring. But when you look at it from orbit, it looks like there's all these spiders. And not something I think that I'd really want to experience, although I'm led to understand that if I was to go to Mars, I probably wouldn't last too long because there's no oxygen.
To any place,
I guess that's important.
So he'll find the spiders.
Yeah, evidently. And yeah, Grogu, I think, I don't know. That Gretchen, you got to understand, that was a long, long time ago, somewhere far, far away. And on that very bad joke, we are going to take a break. And we will be back with an interview. Stay tuned.
Have you seen him? He's from the future. He's got a really big computer. And he uses it every day. And he uses it in every way. What's he use it for? You know, I'm not that sure because it uses future technology.
Welcome back. This is User Friendly 2.0. Check out our website for everything user-friendly. Userfriendly.show is the one-stop shop for all of that. You can play our back episodes, see what's up and coming, submit your questions, give us your comments. We love to hear from you. You can even read our Tech Wednesday articles. Hey, we might need to write one pretty soon again, but you can read them. They're there.
Yay!
Among other things. So let us know what you think. It's how we do our programming, and we love to hear from everybody. So, interesting thing. Last week, we were at the Career Day at Sherwood High School. We had that on the show and our guests and everything, which was really cool. It was a really neat event, and I'm glad we were able to go to it. But one of the things that I had put together, it's really for another purpose, but was able to have there, was a little robot. And people seem to kind of like it. The thing looks like a replicator out of Stargate a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's a 6-leg hexapod. And we're using it as a proof of concept for something a client's doing. But it was kind of cool to be able to have it. And we'd gotten it working, and he died 5 minutes before the event.
So my question is, did you get it fixed?
Yeah, I've gotten them fixed. And what had happened was, and this is part of prototyping, is there's a logic board in there that controls things, and there's a component called a diode, which causes electricity to only go one way. And the reason for that is because the Raspberry Pi circuit that I'm using to build this thing on has some functions that we won't need in the final product. And one of them is it tries to recharge the batteries, but I'm not using rechargeable batteries. So if you do that, it can be extremely problematic. So the purpose of a diode is to make sure the power comes one way and doesn't go back. Well, it was actually the evening before I was finalizing some stuff, and he just stopped working. And it was because this 10-cent diode popped. And there's no way to really replace it. There's no more Radio Shack. I couldn't go buy a diode. I didn't have one here. So unfortunately, these type of things happen. But yes, we got him up and running. And he's actually a neat little guy. He's got a bunch of sensors on him and different things like that. He can tell distance. He can walk properly, which is kind of cool. Self-leveling, all of that type of thing. He has a camera. I don't have any sound system set up on him, although he does have a buzzer. So
a buzzer? What's the buzzer for?
Yeah. To tell us if there's a problem.
Oh.
And I don't think that'll be on the final version either, but it was something that was there. But the thing of it is you're looking at complexity, and any more circuitry you have, especially circuitry you don't need, takes more battery and has more that can possibly go wrong. And a sound card is something that draws a lot of power. To have any kind of ability to reproduce that, you have to have an amplifier circuit in addition to the digital card, a digital to analog converter, and then whatever sound you're going to use, plus a speaker. So there was just no reason to do that because we didn't need it. And it's what that's going to be used for doesn't require sound. But, you know, that's just part of it. You could have it if you wanted it. And the Raspberry Pi prototyping boards do support that kind of thing. So it'd just be a matter of really adding in the appropriate circuitry and turning it on. But again, in this case, didn't have that, don't need it. But the other stuff that's in there is kind of cool. It also has a seismic sensor. One of the things that we're looking at doing with it is when you have something like an earthquake, having the sensor array on it and the final version being a lot smaller, you can put them around. And if a building has collapsed or something of that nature, the little robot can pick up vibrations and stuff that you couldn't otherwise hear. And you can send them into places that you wouldn't want to send a human, because if the robot gets stuck or squished or something, you build another robot. It's not that easy to do with a human. Plus, humans are bigger.
Yeah.
So, yes. You know, from that standpoint, that is one of the uses of this kind of a thing. But it's been a lot of fun. The engineering behind it took some time to put together and get everything to work. And there's two sides of these things. There's the hardware side, which are all of the things to make it move. It's articulated, so there's three different joints in each leg, which means 6 to 18 servo motors plus two more on the neck. So there's a total of 20 servos and all the transistors and data lines and all the stuff to control all of that. And then on the software side of it, you have to program it. When these type of circuits are usually done in either Python or Rust, this one's done in Python because it's running on a Raspberry Pi. And so you have that to set up. So you're looking at a lot of different things, getting the parts built. You have somebody that actually takes the models that I drew up and puts them in and gets the actual physical stuff cut out. It was done on a really high quality 3D printer and a laser printer. That's how they got the parts. And, you know, just kind of cool. But a lot went into it. But yes, he is alive again. He is working, and it was definitely a fun project. We'll have to put a picture of him up in our social media if we haven't done so already. Yeah. All right, well, listen, we got a great interview. I talked about this a little bit in the first segment. This is an author. I am not going to give you any kind of spoilers here because the interview is worth listening to. So with no further ado, let's go. Joining me now, guest T.S. Pedramon. Did I say your name right?
Yes.
Yeah. It only took 9 tries. That's hey, you know what? We're making progress. So tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're doing.
Well, I background, I guess I got my degree in music education. Then I went and I joined the Marine Corps, played clarinet for them for several years. Then I went into cyberspace for the Marine Corps. And then I got out after 12 years on active duty, and now I am working on, I'm an author. Like, I've published a book. If you're watching this video, you can see it behind me. But, I write epic fantasy, and my first book is out. I'm shooting for book 2 to be out later this year, at the end of August.
All right. Well, first of all, on behalf of User Friendly, thank you for your service. And that's a wonderful thing to be able to do. Before we get into the book, I just need to ask the question, what does it mean to go into military cyberspace? Because I've got several ideas and they're probably not right.
Let me try to make this short. The military uses computers. They're very useful for communications. They run weapon systems. And those systems are hackable. And so somebody needs to defend them. And so my second job field, my first one was in the band, and not secondary, but I switched my primary job field from music to being in cyberspace warfare. And cyberspace warfare goes both defense and offense. It's just the billets that I happened to fill where I got stationed were only in defense. But
okay, so that's in this day and age, that is so important.
It's specifically for cyber defense. In the military, there's a difference between cybersecurity and cyber defense, where cybersecurity is basically best practices and making sure everything's configured right and making sure it's things are updated and, like I said, configured right so that it's hard to hack into. Cyber defense is where you are monitoring systems and hunting for signs of malicious action. And out in the civilian realm, that's all just cybersecurity.
Okay. All right. No, that's interesting. That's actually a good topic, I think, for another time. But I'm glad I asked the question because I wouldn't have known really kind of where that went. All right. So let's circle back to what we're here for. Tell us about your book and where did you get the idea to write it? And just let us know a little bit about where this came from.
Okay. Yeah. So, this is not the first book that I wanted to write. In fact, the first one I wanted to write was when I was, I don't know. I remember there was one that I started writing when I was 10. Actually, there were two that I started writing when I was 10 or 12. But in my adult life, when I like really wanted to write a book, the first one was not this. And I started that one in 2010. And that one I'm calling the Grand Hill Chronicles. And, you know, in order to run things as to try to make income as an author, my wife and I registered a company and I have a brand name or what's the word? An imprint that is Grand Hill Media. And in fact, it's on the book here. Like that's Grand Hill Media is the imprint under which this book is published. But I care too much about the Grand Hill Chronicles and I needed to get something out. I needed to have something that I could finish, in some kind of reasonable fashion. So I'm like, okay, some other idea. What's different? What hasn't been done that I know of? How about, a dark unicorn? What does that mean? You know, and so I just, the basis of the idea was just take something that is familiar and add my own twist to it. And so I started playing with the idea, like dark unicorn. Is he like outright evil or is he just sinister or just very somber? So I had to figure those things out and like what other details might be fun to add here. I played with the idea of there just being one male unicorn and then he like carries the banner for a few thousand years or something and then he passes it on to the next male unicorn. And you know, so these were some raw ideas that I played with while I was developing it. So the way it came out is in this world everybody knows unicorns. There's no secret that they exist. Everybody's seen one. Everybody knows what they're like. They're like they have a bright disposition, kind of flighty, and they're intelligent enough. They have the ability to speak. They're not going to carry on a conversation with you and me because they're too flighty, and maybe they don't care about us. I don't know. But they have the ability to heal. Once in a blue moon, somebody will be healed by a unicorn. Also, unicorn isn't the proper word. It's like calling us two legs. It's an accurate description, but it doesn't do us justice, right? And unicorn doesn't do them justice. So in this book, the proper word is namord. And if you say unicorn, it's just not very polite. Yeah, so I actually have, I'll read the little excerpt from the, on the back of the dust jacket. Says,
well, this, no, this sounds great. And just a quick insert here for anybody listening on the radio where we obviously don't have video. We're going to go ahead and post pictures of what you've been referring to on our social media when this airs. Okay. So you didn't miss out. All right, let's go for it.
That evil now comes near to overflowing its bounds, the Namord said. Overflow its bounds? Olava repeated. Perhaps you saw the sky split open last night. Those are cracks in the prison. Olava's face went pale. If those were only cracks, what happens when it breaks? When the prison bursts, all the world will feel it. So that's kind of let you know that there's going to be a big problem that we have to solve, because it's epic fantasy. So in a nutshell, everybody knows what unicorns are like. Also, everybody knows that they're always pure white and they're all female. Except there are the legends of the Nightshade Unicorn, and maybe there's this drawing of this dark unicorn on the cover of the book. But all the legends about the dark unicorn, the Nightshade Unicorn, say he, and some of the stories are preposterous. Like, he's 30 hands high at the shoulder and, you know, obviously ridiculous. But everybody also knows, since unicorns are always white and all female, obviously false, right? Except we meet him in the prologue, so we know that he does exist right off the bat. Yeah, and so the main character, Olava, she's almost 17. In a fantasy world, time is different. Like, if you've ever read the Wheel of Time series by Robert Jordan and finished by Brandon Sanderson, in that world, a year is 500 days.
Okay.
So anyway, so she's almost 17, but she comes of age. Like, she goes, she has her village's coming of age ceremony that she participates in. So she is an adult in her society. But so she comes of age, and then there's this Namord that shows up on the doorstep in the middle of the night. And it's a male Namord. Like, what's with that? And he's like, yeah. There's a problem. The world has a problem, and we need help fixing it. And you're the help. So let's go. And also, we're in a hurry. So come on, like, let's leave now. So there's a journey. And yeah. So the excerpt here on the back of the dust jacket is from that conversation.
Okay. Well, I'm already enthused, and I'm a huge fan of fantasy anyway. So this is right up my, Ali, how long did it take you to write the book?
I had the idea about 2 years ago. And then when I actually had time to sit down and give time to writing it, it was about 2 months. And then there was editing and getting reader feedback. And, you know, so the whole cycle, starting from when I was able to dedicate time to reading it, to writing it, until publishing, was about 6 months, which is...
Okay, now I would consider that to be pretty fast. I mean, you must have been really working on it to get it done that quickly.
I was. I had sleepless nights, to be sure. And
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
So, listener question that comes in a lot on the writing and publishing process is dealing with things like illustrations, and you kind of touched on editing and all of that. What did you have to deal with? Did you actually bring in outside people to do it? Did you do it yourself? How does that work?
I hired an artist for the cover art. I think she did a great job. And that came from vividcovers.com. I'll give her credit. Cause she did a great job and she deserves that credit and more business, you know, you want your book covers done. But, I actually ran a Kickstarter campaign in January, and I didn't have the cover art for it yet. And so the images that I used for that were AI generated. I know there's a lot of hissing and booing about AI image generation. But it helped me in that I was able to have illustrative images for my Kickstarter campaign.
Right.
And then once I got the cover art that I hired an artist for and was able to pay for, I am absolutely glad and proud to use human generated art. It's just, it feels more natural. And I guess AI art will get there and look just as good soon enough, but yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you touch upon that topic, and we've talked about this in the past on the show, and it seems like people's concern is more when one uses AI generated art and then tells you it's human generated art. That's, I think, a lot of the controversy. And like you're saying, I'm seeing a lot of stuff and it's getting better and it's a lot more realistic, but there still isn't the human touch, if you will,
mm-hmm.
that you see when something's done and actually somebody's put in time and care and all of that. So I do agree completely with what you're saying there.
Yeah.
But yeah. All right. Now your book is published. It's going to be published.
It is published.
How would you find it? Where do you order it?
You can find it on Amazon. You can find it on a lot of different places. If your go-to is Amazon, then just search for Nightshade Unicorn. If your go-to is anywhere else, go to pedramon.com and you can find links there. If you really want to help me out, then go to grandhill.media. That's my direct store, but pedramon.com has links to Amazon, to Apple, to Kobo, to Google.
Great. Okay. We'll get that also out in our social media so everybody can find it. All right. Well, is there anything else you want to tell us?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to write, and it was a lot of work, but it was a lot of fun. And I'm looking forward to pushing out book two. My daughter was the first reader for this one. And although it's, you know, I it's YA, it's young adult, kind of geared toward that. It is clean. It's not something you should be worried about putting in front of younger children. My 12-year-old daughter was the first person to read it, and she came back and ordered me to hurry up and write the second book.
Oh, hey, that's the best response you can get.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I loved that, and I wish I could have finished it already. But it's just so much work, and I did publish it myself, like under my own brand, Grand Hill Media.
Right.
And so like I hired out the cover art. I did not hire an editor. I was going to, but the editor that I was going to hire got booked for the time frame, and I already had a publication date goal. But I used a tool called Pro Writing Aid that's pretty good about catching a lot of things. It's also pretty good about missing a lot of things. Not to toot my own horn, but I'm pretty good myself with spelling, grammar, punctuation. I'm not perfect. That's why I use Pro Writing Aid, and I'm not advertising for them. It was a helpful tool. I did not accept all the, because it's an AI-based tool, and it suggests some rewordings if it thinks that maybe your sentence is too long, or it catches four sentences in a row that you started with the same word. Those are good catches, but I also feel like it could be a voice eraser. I know that author Martin Shoemaker has called it that, and I concur with that. Like, if you just go through and accept all the rewordings, you're going to sound kind of manila vanilla. And
well, yeah, and it also wouldn't necessarily be your book. Like you say, it's, you know, changing a lot. All right, so you mentioned that you're working on a second book. So tell us a little bit about where this is going to go and where you would like to see it end up.
Well, it's a sequel. So this book, the series title is Nightshade Unicorn. The title for book one is Forerunner. But obviously, for search terms, use Nightshade Unicorn, because if you search for Forerunner, you're going to find a Toyota SUV. But
yeah.
book two is going to be called Guardian. And it's going to be at least a three book series. I have been very frustrated with life getting in the way, I've had so many things getting in my way and not letting me crank out book two yet. I'm almost there. I have started it, you know. What was I going to say? So there's, I know where it's going to go, and I know, like this big evil that they need to stop when it breaks out of its prison. There is a certain thing that's going to happen. I'm going to be vague. You'll have to wait and find out.
Absolutely. No spoilers here.
there is a certain thing that's going to happen, and it won't be the end. There will have to be another book after that. So bare minimum, even if I like really compress events, book two cannot be the end of the series. It has to have at least one more. And honestly, I could easily see it being five books or beyond. I'm kind of new at this, you know, this is my first book. And so book one has basically one POV character throughout the whole book. I say basically because it's not completely one POV character. The prologue and the epilogue are from one other character's POV. So there are two POV characters in this book. The next book is going to have more. And if you've read Epic Fantasy, if you've read Robert Jordan, then you know that things can start to fill the pages pretty well when you look at this character's perspective and that character's perspective, and then they split apart and go different ways, and then they come back together, and along the way you follow this character and then you follow that character. So yeah, book two will definitely be longer than this one. This one is 94,000 words. For reference, Harry Potter book one was 80,000 words. So it's a little bit longer than Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. It could easily stretch 9-10 books. I don't know yet because I'm new at this, and
you're gonna have to keep us up to date as far as how this goes and what happens, and I can't wait to see it. And again, we're going to get all of your order links and that kind of thing out on our social media, which is at userfriendly.show. So if you're driving right now, don't crash. Just go to the website later and you can get it from there. And I think I'm going to share your direct link first. And the reason for that is nothing against Amazon, but for any small business, Amazon takes a little chunk of the order. That's how they make their money. So, which is fine. But if you can go directly, it helps everybody out. So we'll go ahead and share that out first and have the Amazon link as well.
Yeah. And I guess something else that listeners should know, is I have a newsletter. So maybe you don't want to buy it right away, but you want me to let you know when book two comes out or whenever I run promotions. So you can go to pedramon.com. There's a link for the newsletter. You can sign up for the newsletter. It's absolutely free. And then I'll let you know when I'm running a promotion or when book two comes out, you know?
Okay. That sounds great. All right. And again, we'll get all this posted so you can check it out. And if you have any questions on today's interview, go ahead and send them in. Also at the website, userfriendly.show. We love to hear from you. And listen, thank you so much for joining us today, and the best of luck.
Thank you.
So speaking of books, Gretchen, where are you with the Cyberhawk origin story?
Well, we're in the process of getting the website ready and the book is ready. So we're looking at a couple of days.
Yep, it's almost there. It's amazing how much stuff goes into writing a book, more than writing a book. Well, anyway, thank you for being with us this week. Until next week, this is User Friendly 2.0, keeping you safe on the cutting edge.
User Friendly 2.0 is copyright 2013 to 2024 by User Friendly Media Group Incorporated. All rights reserved. Opinions expressed on the show are those of the hosts and guests and not this radio station. Please check out userfriendly.show for airtimes and podcasts.